This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Democratic Party presidential candidate Hillary Clinton gave a lengthy foreign policy speech in San Diego, California, on Thursday evening, just days ahead of the state's crucial primary election. Her speech was not as much a survey of her positions as much as a takedown of Donald Trump, the presumptive GOP nominee. Clinton shot out clever one-liners clearly intended to provoke Trump, such as calling him, quote, dangerously incoherent and, quote, thin-skinned. Now, she is, of course, right on Trump, and her criticisms are obvious, but what was most interesting were those moments during her speech when she revealed her positions on how we as a nation would interact with the world and how she would lead it as Commander-in-Chief. My guest is Phyllis Bennis. She's the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, the author of numerous books, including Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, and Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. Welcome to the program, Phyllis.
Good to be with you, Sonali.
Well, first of all, what are your general impressions of the speech? As I said, the vast majority of it was aimed squarely and unflinchingly at Donald Trump, and some people have criticized her for it, others have lauded her for it. What do you think?
Well, I think whatever else it was not the, quote, major foreign policy address that the campaign had promised. It was a campaign address. It was a very good put down of Donald Trump's very dangerous policy proposals. I think that's rather easy to do. She did it very well. She got her appropriate laugh lines, her applause lines, her booing lines, and she came across as very strong in her recognition of the various dangers posed by Trump's very dangerous policies. The difficult part, as you say, came when she was trying to explain her own policies. Both what she said and what she very carefully did not speak about was sorely problematic, because while she was focusing on Trump's both specific, really dangerous policies like his Islamophobia, the exclusion of Muslims, his threats to use nuclear weapons against ISIS, his sort of offhand reference to, well, maybe countries like South Korea or Saudi Arabia should be given nuclear weapons for their own self-protection, you know, things like that. But also his overall, he's incoherent, he's not somebody, he's not temperamentally suited for this job. And she came across as somebody who is temperamentally very suited. She's firm. She's very clear about her politics. She's experienced. She's definitive. She's all those things based on a policy that's grounded in war. That's what's really dangerous. She wanted to talk about her experience as the diplomat in chief, but all of her experience is as cheerleading for war, not cheerleading for diplomacy.
So I want to play an excerpt from her speech. This was the first instance in the speech, you know, quite a ways through the speech, where she starts surveying her foreign policy experience. Here it is.
Unlike him, I have some experience with the tough calls and the hard work of statecraft. I wrestled with the Chinese over a climate deal in Copenhagen, brokered a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, negotiated the reduction of nuclear weapons with Russia, twisted arms to bring the world together in global sanctions against Iran, and stood up for the rights of women, religious minorities, and LGBT people around the world.
And so Clinton basically, you know, talking about being a champion for the rights of women, religious minorities, LGBT people. In that survey was one really interesting moment where she said she twisted arms to bring the world together in global sanctions against Iran. I think there, Phyllis, was the biggest hint of the kind of war hawk she would be as president, right?
Well, it was a very interesting moment because there and again later when she spoke about the Iran deal, she's coming out more directly supportive of the Iran deal than she has been in the past. But in all the references to it in this speech, she focused on her own role, not as a diplomat, not as negotiating with other nations, but as the tough one. I'm the one who was tasked with bringing these other reluctant nations to agree with us on sanctions. I'm the one who twisted arms. So her self-defined credibility is not based on being the what the Secretary of State is supposed to be, the diplomat in chief, but rather playing this very hardcore pro-military role, where even if she wasn't officially the Secretary of Defense, couldn't officially be the one who orders troops off, she's making clear that her own role was that of being the tough guy. I can be as tough as anybody else. That was the message that she was so clear on, even in the Iran deal, which is arguably the most important single diplomatic accomplishment of the entire Obama administration.
So the next excerpt I want to play is where she sort of immediately delves into the kind of arguments around American exceptionalism that we've heard from Obama and previous presidents. And I suppose this is this sort of obligatory thing that presidential candidates and presidents feel like they have to say about America being an exceptional country. But this was really interesting. Well, let's play a clip and I'll ask you about it.
And I believe with all my heart that America is an exceptional country, that we're still, in Lincoln's words, the last best hope of Earth. We are not a country that cowers behind walls. We lead with purpose and we prevail. And if America doesn't lead, we leave a vacuum. And that will either cause chaos or other countries will rush in to fill the void. Then they'll be the ones making the decisions about your lives and jobs and safety. And trust me, the choices they make will not be to our benefit. That is not an outcome we can live with.
And this is Hillary Clinton talking about the United States being the last best hope of Earth. And that if America doesn't lead, other countries will step in and make decisions about our lives and jobs and safety. I suppose like the U.S. makes decisions about other people's lives.
Precisely. This was an extraordinary thing because what she was saying here was not just the usual, as you say, what every presidential candidate says, America is an exceptional country. American exceptionalism is an ongoing theme of pretty much every presidential campaign. But you can define that in many different ways. You could define American exceptionalism by the language of our Constitution, by the Bill of Rights, by the fact that we've changed the Constitution, recognizing its inadequacies. The Constitution recognized slavery, and a later effort undermined slavery. So, you know, you can do all that. That's not what Hillary Clinton did in this speech. What she was saying was, not only we are an exceptional country, but every other country in the world recognizes how important it is that we are an exceptional country. It was really this claim of, I know what the rest of the world thinks, and they want us to be strong and exceptional and telling them what to do. Because God forbid, if we're not telling them what to do, someone else might, and who knows what would happen. So it was really a rather extraordinary expansion of this notion of American exceptionalism to impute to the rest of the world the view that the United States is the shining city on the hill, which I would venture to say not too many countries and certainly not too many peoples around the world would take that view of the United States these days.
Right. So she went on to talk a little bit more about Iran, and it was really interesting what she took credit for and what she implied she should be credited for. Here again is Hillary Clinton in the foreign policy speech that she gave on Thursday.
When President Obama took office, Iran was racing toward a nuclear bomb. Some called for military action. But that could have ignited a broader war that could have mired our troops in another Middle Eastern conflict. President Obama chose a different path. And I got to work leading the effort to impose crippling sanctions. We brought Iran to the table. We began talks.
And that's Hillary Clinton saying, we brought Iran to the table. We began talks. We eventually reached an agreement that could block every path for Iran to get a nuclear weapon. But she talked about how she led the effort to impose crippling global sanctions. Phyllis, I want to ask you, what exactly did Clinton, you know, do for the Iran deal? Which part of the Iran deal can she be held responsible for? Because it seems to me that Secretary Kerry really oversaw the detente with Iran, the warming of relations with Iran. How much credit does she deserve?
Well, I think the question is, how much responsibility does she bear? I'm not sure I would put too much of it in the credit category. She does say, and I think this is accurate, that her role, because she was, again, we have to keep in mind the timing here. She was the Secretary of State in the first 4 years the first Clinton term from 2009 through 2013. That was about the time, 2013, when the Iran negotiations were really ratcheting up. So she was no longer the Secretary of State through the most important part of those negotiations. Now, granting that, it's still fascinating that as the so-called diplomat in chief, she still is focusing on and even using the term crippling sanctions. That's the term that I use, that you use, when we describe the impact of these sanctions on the people of Iran. The fact that she's using that as something to be proud of is really rather a scary proposition, because what she's saying, and it's accurate, is she was tasked with the job of forcing the Iranians to the table, not negotiating, not treating Iran as an equal country, not treating Iran as a serious regional power with whom we share many interests and with whom we have many competitive interests as well, but as a serious country to be dealt with seriously. Instead, she was tasked with treating them as an enemy, seeing what kinds of pressures could be brought to bear at any cost, including at any cost to the people of Iran. That's where that term, the crippling sanctions, comes in. So I think that she's right, but she also, I just found it astonishing that, not astonishing, I shouldn't say that, I wasn't so surprised, but it is rather shocking that the Secretary of State is bragging about having played a role that had less to do with diplomacy than about pressure. And she went on to assert the longstanding claim that has been debunked so many times that Iran was quote, racing towards a nuclear bomb. Well, we know from all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies that Iran's government had not even ever made a decision about whether they wanted to have a nuclear weapons program, let alone racing towards a nuclear bomb. So simply saying that on the basis of, well, really, who's going to challenge her? And the problem is, no one's challenging her. The mainstream press is not picking that up. I don't imagine Donald Trump is likely to pick up that one as something to challenge Hillary Clinton on. So she's sort of getting away with these assertions that are simply not accurate. The final thing on the Iran point, which I think was very, very dangerous, although very consistent with her positions, is that it was at that moment that she chose to bring up the question of Israel. And she did it in the context of the Iran deal, saying that it was very clear that as she pivoted away from the deal itself to say that I would remind everybody that the U.S. will act, I think her words were, decisively, if necessary, including with military action against Iran if the deal should fall through, because after all, she says, Israel's security is not negotiable. Now, why is that even an issue? Everybody agreed that Israel, to whatever degree they felt they were at danger from Iran, and I think most people believe that that Iran did not pose an existential threat, does not pose an existential threat to Israel, it poses a threat to Israel's nuclear monopoly, which is not such a bad thing to have that nuclear monopoly challenged, that's what would happen with a nuclear-armed Iran if it were ever to take place. But I think the fact that she's asserting it in the context of, don't forget, we would always be ready to use military force because Israel's security is non-negotiable. Israel's security is also not at risk. So it was a really unnecessary reassertion of her longstanding political defense of Israel, no matter what the Israeli violations of international law might be.
Right. I mean, she has very openly embraced Benjamin Netanyahu, much more so than even Obama did. So
she's invited him, said that would be the first thing she would do in the White House is invite Netanyahu, a direct rebuttal to, as you say, to Obama's rather, shall we say, frosty relationship with the Israeli prime minister.
So let's talk about ISIS. This is where Hillary Clinton sort of did us a favor and most clearly, I think, of any of her foreign policy positions, spelled it out for us. You've written a book on ISIS, so I'm really eager to hear what you think of what she had to say. Here is Hillary Clinton expressing her foreign policy or summarizing her foreign policy on the Islamic State.
Over the past year, I've laid out my plans for defeating ISIS. We need to take out their strongholds in Iraq and Syria by intensifying the air campaign and stepping up our support for Arab and Kurdish forces on the ground. We need to keep pursuing diplomacy to end Syria's civil war and close Iraq's sectarian divide because those conflicts are keeping ISIS alive. We need to lash up with our allies and ensure our intelligence services are working hand in hand to dismantle the global network that supplies money, arms, propaganda, and fighters to the terrorists. And we need to win the battle in cyberspace.
And that's Hillary Clinton talking about, quote, taking out ISIS strongholds in Iraq and Syria, intensifying the air campaign and stepping up support for forces on the ground. This is similar to the language Obama has used when talking about ISIS and other U.S. War hawks have used, taking out terrorists. What do you make of this? It doesn't sound like anything terribly unusual or terribly different from what we might expect, right?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think she did do a very good job at identifying some of the particularly dangerous things that Donald Trump has said in the past about what he would do regarding ISIS, some of which are really extreme. The notion of declaring Syria to be a so-called free zone for ISIS. He talked about, at one point, sending tens of thousands of U.S. troops. At another point, he talked about isolationism and just withdrawing all the troops. At one point, he even mentioned the possibility of using nuclear weapons against ISIS. It's sort of crazy and dangerous. So that was fine. She spoke very powerfully of that. But as you say, when she talked about what she would do, it was a much more careful description and one that is really very, very similar to the failed policies that we've seen from the U.S. so far. She talked about what would be a real plan. So she would intensify the air campaign and step up support for the Arab and Kurdish forces on the ground. But what does that mean? Would she send ground troops? Would she send thousands more special ops? Would she send more planes? We know that's failing. It's succeeding only at killing people. It's not succeeding at ending ISIS. So what would she do differently? She didn't really have much to say about that. Working with allied intelligence agencies to try and cut supplies. That's actually underway already, and that's having a little bit of success, the part that's not involved with dropping bombs on these homemade oil refineries, which is simply destroying the environment and killing a lot of people in the meantime, and strengthening defenses here at home, winning the war in cyberspace. What does that mean? What's she actually going to do? Those are nice goals, you know, strengthen defenses here at home. So she wants us to live in a police state? She
right,
she
cited the San Bernardino incident. So that implies that more incursions into our privacy from the NSA?
Maybe. She didn't say. She didn't specify. And that's really the problem. She's, on the one hand, trying to claim that she represents the Obama position because she's angling, obviously, for an endorsement from President Obama sooner rather than later. And so far, she hasn't gotten that. But in the meantime, she's not actually proposing anything different than what the Obama strategy is supposed to be achieving. But of course, it's a failed strategy. It's still failing. There's absolutely no reason to think it's going to succeed any differently in the future.
So finally, I want to play one last clip from the speech that Hillary Clinton gave on Thursday in San Diego, California. This is where she basically wants to jump on the We Got Bin Laden bandwagon and describing the moment sitting in the Situation Room with President Obama debating the Bin Laden operation. Here again is Hillary Clinton.
I remember being in the Situation Room with President Obama debating the potential Bin Laden operation. The president's advisors were divided. The intelligence was compelling, but far from definitive. And the risks of failure were daunting. The stakes were significant for our battle against Al-Qaeda and our relationship with Pakistan. Most of all, the lives of those brave SEALs and helicopter pilots hung in the balance. It was a decision only a president could make. And when he did, it was as crisp and courageous a display of leadership as I've ever seen.
And she talks about the crisp and courageous display of leadership from Obama, presumably one that she would emulate in such future situations as this. Now, Phyllis, what did you make of this, her bringing this up? Because the issue of what actually happened with the Bin Laden operation has come under big questions.
It has, and it was again, although not surprising, given her positioning herself as a war leader and an experienced military leader, despite the fact that she's never commanded troops, she's not been the Secretary of Defense, she's not been in the military or trained as a military strategist or tactician or logistician or any such thing. But what she was trying to do here was two things. One is to, as you say, identify and praise Obama's leadership and imply, I would do the same thing. At the other side, she was implying that she was part of the decision-making in the Situation Room. Now, I wasn't a fly on the wall in that meeting. I would have been interested to be, but no one asked me. And I think that what's likely is this was a military operation about to begin. I doubt that the diplomat in chief was the one who was providing the moment-to-moment information that the president was relying on when he made the final decision about yes or no. Now, ideally, the Secretary of State, the diplomat in chief, would have been providing immediate and earlier information about the likely consequences diplomatically and in other ways, in terms of human costs, et cetera, of this operation. Was Hillary Clinton the one who warned President Obama at that last moment that this operation could really destroy the U.S.-Pakistani relationship? Was she the one warning that the preliminary work that had been done that involved sending Pakistani doctors posing as doing a vaccination campaign when they were actually there to try and confirm the DNA of people in what turned out to be bin Laden's compound? Was she the one warning that that could have really serious ramifications for healthcare workers in Pakistan for years to come? I don't think so. That's not what she was bragging about. She was bragging by implication, not by statement, because it would be too obvious that it wasn't quite accurate to say that she was the one helping the president make the decision to begin that raid. But that's what she wanted the world to think. I was in the Situation Room. She ignores who else might have been there. I was the one helping President Obama with this crisp display of leadership. That's what she wants us to take away from this speech.
Finally, Phyllis, what wasn't said in that speech that you wish had been? I noticed the absence of her role, of her foreign policy positions on Central America. I mean, pretty much this hemisphere was entirely left out of it, except when she criticized Trump on his position on Mexico, saying it's really nice that we have friendly neighbors to the north and south.
Right. Well, many things were left out, and certainly her key role in enabling the coup in Honduras was left out. But I think one of the things that was more immediate to what she was focusing on in her speech that was left out was her role in Libya. Her role in Libya was as cheerleader in chief for the U.S. to engage militarily with NATO in the military assault on Libya aimed at regime change against Gaddafi. That was at a moment when Obama was very much hesitating about whether to support a direct U.S. engagement. And it wasn't the Secretary of Defense, the military guy, Robert Gates, who happens to be a Republican, who was pushing for the military. He was the one warning. And he said in a meeting that Hillary Clinton was part of when she was Secretary of State, he was the one who warned a no-fly zone starts with going to war against Libya. Hillary Clinton was the one who was saying, yeah, we're going to war. She was the cheerleader in chief for war against Libya, the war that has left Libya absolutely devastated, engulfed in violence, with the military supplies, the weapons of Libya that have now spread across the Middle East, throughout Central and North Africa, that are being seen, these weapons are being seen at conflict zones throughout that whole part of the world. It's been an absolute disaster. We didn't hear any reference to that, despite the fact that the one concrete thing that Hillary Clinton has been proposing to do in Syria that distinguishes herself from all of her competitors and from President Obama is calling for an exactly the same no-fly zone in Syria, which, if you take the advice of then Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, means going to war not only against the Syrian government, but against Syria's military backers, going to war against Iran and Russia. It's an incredibly reckless position. So not surprisingly, when she's trying to distinguish herself from the recklessness of what a Trump policy would look like, what a Trump presidency would look like, not surprisingly, she didn't mention the most reckless of her own policy proposals.
Phyllis Bennis, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us and spending this time with us.
Thank you, Sonali. It's been a pleasure.
Phyllis Bennis is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, the author of numerous books, including Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.